Let me start off by welcoming you all to this Stop War Forum. My name is Sharon Yandel, and I will be chairing tonight on behalf of Stop War. As many of you will know, Stop War CA is a broadly based coalition of 160 organizations plus individuals that was formed in November 2002, as part of the worldwide effort at that time opposing what appeared to be and what turned out to be an impending war against Iraq. Along with numerous other international organizations, we continue to press for an end to the war and occupation in Iraq and for peace and justice in the Middle East. In the course of the past year in particular, it has become increasingly clear that to achieve these goals requires not just stop war, but stop empire. And the focus on tonight's event is exactly that. Our topic is opposing U.S. empire by war and by trade. If war is an extension of diplomacy by other means, so also is war an extension of trade by other means. More to the point, an extension of the trade deals and all that they bring and have brought. Privatization, the gutting of social programs, the driving down of wages and general impoverishment. To understand the whys and wherefores of the war against Iraq, we need to understand how militarism and these trade deals come together, how they complement each other in the push for empire and the globalization that we have come to know so well, if not love. Tonight, we are fortunate to have with us two speakers and social activists well-versed in the components of war, trade, and empire. To my immediate right, to your left, is Steve, my far right, is Steve Staples. Steve is the director of the Polaris Institute Project on the Corporate Security State. Many of you will know him from his former position. He was the coordinator of End the Arms Race here in BC and was the BC organizer for the Council of Canadians for a number of years. I think you were here 10 years, is that correct? Steve researches the relationship between corporate globalization, militarism, and security. He works, as the Polaris Institute does, with the citizen organizations in Canada, the U.S., and internationally to develop new tools for democratic social change. Steve is the author of many articles, publications, and media commentaries, and speaks to audiences around the world on issues of peace and social justice. Tonight, he's going to speak on the militarization of the Canadian economy and what we might expect from the not-yet-elected Prime Minister, Paul Martin. David Bacon is a labor reporter and a photojournalist from California. He is the author of a just-released book, in fact, I think it's pre-released, is that right, David? That is entitled The Children of NAFTA, Labor Wars on the U.S.-Mexico Border. It's a book about the impact of what has been called the harsh neoliberal economic policies on the people of the South. David recently returned from Iraq, and he's here to give a first-hand account of the current attempts to privatize the Iraqi economy. He is an eyewitness to U.S. attempts to shift the focus, as far as the Iraqi people will allow it, from the acts of war back to the imposition of empire by other means. So what I would like to do is to call first upon David, and I'm going to ask both David and Steve to speak for about 30 minutes. And after that, we'll open the floor up to a question and answer and comment process. So without further ado, I'd call upon David. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me up here with you. It's a pleasure to be in a rational city and to be on a panel with Stephen Staples, a very distinguished scholar and activist, and to be with you. I want to talk tonight about what I was able to observe on the ground in Baghdad and what people told me. So I'm going to act as a reporter, really, and kind of like letting the people who I spoke with speak to you through me. And just to set the scene a little bit, first of all, I went to Iraq in October as one of two people sent by U.S. Labor Against the War, which is a network of unions, local unions, labor councils. We even have one state labor federation now, who came together before the war started in order to oppose it and have continued in existence in order to oppose the occupation and to develop labor opposition in the effort to try and end it. So myself and Clarence Thomas, and Clarence is, we like to call Clarence the good Clarence Thomas because we have a Supreme Court justice who we call the bad one. And Clarence was the secretary treasurer of the San Francisco Longshore Local during the lockout. And, you know, I'm going to do this also just so that I don't go over time. Oh, good. Okay. And so he went there representing his local, and I went there representing the Newspaper Guild local in San Francisco. It's a very strange experience in a lot of ways, going to Baghdad. You can't fly into the Baghdad airport. The airport's closed, so you fly into Amman, Jordan. And there's no bus system which goes from Amman to Baghdad, so there's sort of an impromptu system of SUVs that ferry people back and forth between the Amman airport and Baghdad. And so Clarence and I landed at the airport, got into the SUV, and took off for the border. And you drive through Jordan, and you're driving down these tiny little one-lane roads. And then you get to the border with the border of Iraq. And the first thing is that it's very easy to cross. You just pay $15, they stamp your passport, and away you go. In fact, you know how to make a telephone call from New York to Baghdad? You dial 1-941 and then the number. In other words, it's not an international call. It's like calling Kansas City. So you just cross the border, but immediately things change. And the first thing that changes is that you are on a three-lane freeway all the way from the border to Baghdad with freeway exits, signs in English and Arabic. And what it lets you know right away is that at one time Iraq was a very wealthy industrialized country, even though it feels very different now. Baghdad itself is a large city, 5.5 million people approximately. And despite all the talk about reconstruction and the $87 billion that was appropriated by Congress for the reconstruction of Iraq, we didn't see a single construction crane in the entire city. So what you see of Baghdad and what it feels like to ordinary Iraqi people is a city that's still suffering from the effects of war. The rubble is still in the streets. The buildings that were partially blown away by shells are still in the same condition that they were. The electricity goes out a number of times a day. The water is bad. I got sick, but even one of the people that was helping to arrange logistics for us who lives in Baghdad got sick during the time that we were there. Because the water treatment plant doesn't work, and so the raw sewage is dumped into the Tigris River, which is where a lot of people get their water from. So the conditions of life are very difficult for everybody that lives in Iraq and in Baghdad right now. But in particular, life is very difficult for working people. And this is, I think, one aspect of the war that is just completely absent from the media, at least in the United States. Now, I don't live in Canada, and perhaps things are drastically different here, but I suspect not. Because what we see in the U.S. of the war coming at us in newspapers and on television and the radio is images of war and violence, but you don't see anything that gives you an idea of what life is like for Iraqi people. In fact, in talking with audiences in the U.S. about unions and workers in Iraq, the first question you get is, workers in Iraq? It's a surprise, and I think that just simply reflects what we're not getting from the media that we're exposed to. So, to tell you a little bit about what conditions are, we visited three plants: an oil refinery, the largest shoe factory in the Middle East, and a vegetable oil plant. And unemployment in Iraq right now hovers at about 70%. So you wonder, how can people possibly survive with 70% unemployment? What about those 70%? That $87 billion that was appropriated by Congress for reconstruction, how many of those dollars do you think go for creating an unemployment benefit system for unemployed Iraqi workers? How many dollars? Guess.
Zero.
Zero, right. So people survive because every person that has a job is supporting many people who don't. We spoke to women sewing machine operators in the shoe factory who told us that they were supporting six and sometimes even as many as 10 other family members and friends with the job that they had. In the oil refinery, wages are very low, and I'll get to the wages in a minute, but the management of the oil refinery, in an attempt to help the workers survive, was giving them an allotment of motor oil every month that the workers would then turn over to their children, who would sell it at oil stands on the highway outside the oil refinery to passing vehicles. So that's another way in which people survive. And actually, the lines at gas stations are so long that you could easily spend all day in the line and never get to the gas pump. And so there's a black market in gasoline. And Iraqis are very bitter and angry about this because they say, you know, we have more oil in Iraq than any other country in the world, practically, and yet there's no gasoline in the gas stations. And if we want gas, we have to buy it on the black market at five times of what it costs at a gas station. So the conditions are pretty difficult, and that gives you some idea about how people survive. In the oil refinery that we went to the Al Dawra oil refinery, which is just outside of Baghdad, one of the three major refineries in the country. And we met with workers who told us that the work shift in the refinery, or two work shifts, one's 11 hours long, one's 13 hours long. Because of the impact of sanctions, there's no safety equipment. And in refineries are very dangerous places to work. And we saw workers turning the handles on the valves and the equipment in the power plant, which were very hot, with rags because they didn't have gloves. I didn't see a single hard hat when I was there, no masks, no safety equipment. And, you know, Iraqi workers are very sophisticated people. They know what, you know, this international standard is for safety in a refinery, and they know what they don't have. So again, this is a source of a lot of anger. In the vegetable oil plant, we saw a plant that had dead machines all over the plant floor. The reason for that being, again, the impact of sanctions, that it was impossible for the plant to get spare parts for the machines. And these were machines that made plastic bottles to hold the vegetable oil out of polyvinyl chloride. And because they used PVC in the plant was inspected for chemical weapons production 20 times since the first Gulf War, because PVC is supposedly a dual-use chemical. So, this was a very kind of bitter and ironic place because of the, you know, just seeing machine after machine after machine with no parts to make it operable. But that also gave you an idea about what situation Iraqi workers are in, and that is that they need something to happen in the Iraqi economy that's going to fix those machines or buy new machines and put people to work and get the economy moving again. And none of that is happening right now. And then finally, we went and saw workers at the shoe factory, mostly women sewing machine operators, and they told us what the general wage level is for Iraqi workers, which right now is about $60 a month. They said, however, that people's income had actually fallen since the occupation began, because although that $60 a month is approximately the same as what people were getting in a money wage before the occupation started, in other words, under Saddam Hussein. People were getting food subsidies and subsidies for housing before the occupation started, and all of that was ended when the occupation began. So people continually expressed to us that that we thought that we were going to be better off after the occupation and instead were worse off. And that was said in many different ways by people over and over and over again. Now, we found unions in all three of those plants. And I would venture to say that there are probably there's probably no factory in Baghdad and Basra, at least, that doesn't have a union committee there now. And I want to talk a little bit about who those unions are and how they came into being. And to do this, it helps to understand a little bit of history. Iraq was a creation of the British, really. It was formerly a part of the Ottoman Empire, and at the end of World War I, when the British defeated the Ottoman Empire, they drew the lines that are now the borders of Iraq in the same way that the lines were drawn for the borders of countries in Africa and elsewhere in the world. And the reason why the British were interested in Iraq was because of the oil, and the British were the people who dug the first oil wells and then set up the industry that was built in Iraq in order to facilitate the exportation or the taking of the oil out of Iraq. And this all happened in the 1920s. And so the first unions that were organized by Iraqi workers were organized in the first industries, which were the oil industry and on the railroads and in the ports. And these were illegal unions under the British, and there were a couple of examples of strikes even as early as the 1921 and 22 that were suppressed by the British, who fired on strikers. The British then set up a king in Iraq who ruled Iraq from then until 1958. And under the king of Iraq, unions were illegal as well. And we had the good fortune to interview a man named Mohsen Mulali when we were in Baghdad. And Mohsen Mulali was a hero of the Iraqi labor movement. He went to work on the docks in Basra in 1949 as a young man and began organizing unions there. By 1952, he had helped organize a big strike of dock workers and fled to Kuwait. The emir of Kuwait turned him back over to the king of Iraq, who threw him in prison in 1954. And Mohsen Mulali stayed in prison until the Iraqi Revolution of 1958, when unions became legal for the first time, and when Iraq's course of economic development was changed. In 1958, the Iraqi government that came to power began using the oil revenue to build Iraq's industry. And most of the factories that are in Iraq today, and there are about 600 major large-scale factories in Iraq, were built in the period immediately following that 1958 revolution. So they were nationalized plants. They were plants built by the Iraqi government. And during that period, unions became very well organized and had a lot of political power. The CIA engineered a coup in Iraq in 1963, which got rid of Karim Qasem, who was the prime minister. And then the Ba'ath Party came to power, and Saddam Hussein took control of the Ba'ath Party in the late 1960s. And from 1977 to 1979, he purged the Iraqi labor movement of the left-wing and democratic-minded unionist political parties on the left in Iraq were banned. And the people like Mohsen Mulali were driven underground or imprisoned or into exile. So Mohsen Mulali again spent another stint in prison, 2.5 years this time. And most Iraqi unionists were driven out of the country. And the reason why it's important to kind of know this history is because when the occupation started and when the Saddam Hussein regime fell, these people came back to Iraq, or they came up from underground, and they began organizing unions very quickly. There was a general strike in Basra before the U.S. troops had even reached Baghdad. There was a trade union council organized in Basra by April. And in June in Baghdad, there was a meeting of about 400 trade union activists, which set up the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions. And from that meeting, they set up 12 different unions for the 12 main industries in Iraq. And from that meeting, they sent workers out to the different factories in Baghdad and Basra and other Iraqi cities. The union that we found at the plant, at the refinery, the Al-Dawra oil refinery, was organized because one of those activists had come from that June meeting out to the plant, had talked to the workers there, urged them to get started organizing the union there. The workers had then elected committees in the 9 different departments of the refinery, and those department committees had elected a plant-wide committee, and that's where the union came from. So it was basically a union that was set up by workers at their own initiative in a very democratic way. The other two plants that we visited had unions there also that were organized by workers who didn't bother waiting for somebody to come and urge them to do it. They just set up their own union committees, and they then affiliated their union committees with the second trade union federation that we found on the ground there, and that was the Federation of Workers' Unions and Councils, which also includes a union for unemployed people, the Unemployed Union of Iraq. Whichever way these unions were formed, they all had the same experience, and that is that these union committees went to the managers of these plants and said, okay, we want to talk to you about these 11-hour shifts or the $60 wage or the lack of safety equipment or the other problems that the workers had. And the managers all said, well, you know, the plant's not ours. We just report to the minister, so we can't do anything without getting permission from our ministry. So in the oil refinery, for instance, the manager of the refinery wrote to the oil minister, and the oil minister then wrote to the finance minister, and the finance minister wrote to the person who actually makes these decisions in Iraq today, and that's Paul Bremer. And so the answer came down the chain in the same way, and the answer was the same in every case, and that was, the Iraqi labor code since 1987 has contained a provision that was issued by Saddam Hussein that says that workers in the public sector in Iraq are not actually workers but are civil servants, and as such, they don't have the right to have unions and cannot engage in collective bargaining. Therefore, you as the manager of the plant cannot talk to these workers. And to make this point really, really, really clear, Bremer issued an order in June called Public Notice Number 1. And Public Notice Number 1 says that anybody who even advocates, not participates in, but anybody who even advocates anything that leads to civil disorder will be detained and treated as a prisoner of war under the Geneva Convention. And if that wasn't clear enough, in December, troops arrived at the headquarters building of the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions. The troops detained 8 members of the union's National Executive Board. They painted over the name of the union on the outside of the building. They took the union's files, and they expelled the union from the building. Kasim Hadi, who is the head of the unemployed union, has been arrested 3 times now for the crime of leading demonstrations of unemployed workers down to the doors of the Coalition of Provisional Authority, demanding revolutionary changes like unemployment benefits and jobs. In Basra, which is now a hotbed of labor activity, unions are organizing even more quickly and facing even a more difficult situation. And just to give you an idea of what the economic situation is that's sort of impelling this, right now a kilo of potatoes or onions in Basra or Baghdad costs about 2,000 Iraqi dinars, which is about $1.30 in U.S. dollars, which would make it in Canadian money, I guess, maybe about $1.60 or $1.70. At 60 U.S. dollars a month, that's 3 U.S. dollars a day. The net of it being that as a worker in that factory, you have to work half a shift, half a day, in order to be able to buy a kilo of onions or potatoes. That's pretty extreme economic pressure that people are under. So that's one important reason why people are organizing. And if that wasn't bad enough, you know, the occupation authority is the employer in Iraq. They're the boss, because these are all state-owned plants. And who is the state in Iraq right now? Paul Bremer. So they have been issuing wage orders since the occupation began, dictating the wages and the working conditions for Iraqi workers. And in December, Bremer issued an order saying that the bottom-level wage in Iraqi factories should be $40 a month, not $60. The union at the Southern Oil Company, which is one of the big national oil companies in Iraq, they went to the manager of the company, and they said, if you try and implement this, we're going to stop the production of oil. And the oil minister flew down from Baghdad and immediately agreed to reinstate the $60 a month wage. Then the union did a survey, a price survey, and they determined that, in their opinion, the absolute rock-bottom survival-level wage for an Iraqi factory worker should be about $130 a month. And 2 weeks ago, in the first big victory for Iraqi unions, the oil ministry and Bremer were forced to agree that in the Iraqi oil industry, the bottom-level wage is now going to be $130 a month. Iraqi workers, when they look at the occupation, what they say is that the occupation has an economic purpose. And what they point to is, first of all, things like Directive Number 39, issued by the Occupation Authority in September, which says that for the first time since 1958, an Iraqi factory can belong to a private corporation, it can be a foreign corporation, and it can take the profits of that factory and take them out of Iraq. Now, if the rationale for privatization is that it's necessary to have some investment from outside to invest in those new machinery and new parts, like for those dead machines on the floor of the vegetable oil plant, in order to get those machines running and employ more people and get the economy working again, the last thing you want is an ordinance that says you can take that profit and take it out of the country. So Iraqi workers say this is not a law for the reinvestment in Iraq, this is a law for the looting of the Iraqi economy. And then they point to things like Bremer's $40 wage order and say that the impact of that order is that it actually lowers the standard of living of Iraqi workers in order to make that low standard of living a basis for attracting foreign investment. And in fact, every week in London and Washington these days, there are conferences in which management consultants put the assets of the Iraqi state out on the table and invite in large corporations to come and take a look at what might be available for purchase in the new Iraq. So what unions told us that they want are the following things. First of all, they want legal status. They want the right to exist. And they want the right to bargain. But they don't want to just bargain over the loss of their jobs. The manager of the Al Daura oil refinery told us that if that refinery is privatized and sold to a foreign corporation, that he would have to lay off half of the plant's workers, 1,500 out of the 3,000 people who work there. Now, with 70% unemployment, laying off 1,500 people is almost like sentencing people to death because there is no unemployment benefits, no means for people to survive without those jobs. And everybody working in one of those jobs is supporting a lot of people who aren't. So those unions don't want to just negotiate over the impact of privatization, how many jobs are going to be lost, whether workers should get some kind of severance pay or retraining or what have you. They want to be able to bargain over the decision to privatize itself. They want enough political power to be able to say it should either go forward or it should not go forward. So what that means is that they want labor rights, but they also want the political power to determine what the nature and the direction and the shape of the Iraqi economy is going to be and who it's going to serve. The Iraqi labor code, they say, has to be rewritten, because it contains things like this 1987 law that says that public workers can't bargain. But there are other parts of the Iraqi labor code that they'd like to keep, things that say that workers have the right to housing, that workers have the right to free medical care, that were put into the Iraqi labor code back when it was written in 1958. So they want to be able to keep those things that favor workers and unions and get rid of the restrictions. But in order to be able to accomplish that, they need political power, and they say that they need the occupation to end. So their message is that they want an end to the occupation, and they want a system in Iraq in which they have the political power to make some decisions over what's going to affect them. The last thing is to really think about is the controversy that is out there in the media because of these proposals from the United States for the transition to a new Iraqi government in June. And there are people like Sheikh Sistani who are calling for direct elections, and the United States is saying that there should be some sort of caucus system, as though Iraqi people were living in Iowa, and they could walk down to their precinct and pick the candidate of their choice. That's not really what's going on. You know, in the U.S. press, this is always played out as being some kind of a religious struggle. The Shiites, who are the majority, they want to dominate the new Iraq, and there's a danger in the domination of the fundamentalist Shiites, and therefore a democratic election process is a bad idea. The problem that the United States has and that Bremer has is not that the Shiites are going to come to power in a system of direct elections. It's that they have an economic plan for Iraq, one that Wolfowitz and Richard Perle were writing about long before Bush even stole the election in Florida. And they need an Iraqi government which is willing to implement that plan. And you know, the Iraqi Governing Council, the 24 members of the Iraqi Governing Council, if they had to take a vote on privatization right now, Bremer couldn't get 12 votes in the Iraqi Governing Council for the privatization of the Iraqi economy. So if there are direct elections in Iraq, the chances are very, very good that the government that's elected is not going to be willing to carry out this economic plan. And so here's where all these proposals come forward for some means of choosing an Iraqi government or appointing an Iraqi government that will essentially do what it's told. So what Iraqi unions and Iraqi workers told us in the course of our brief visit is that they want a democratic system of government in Iraq which allows them the ability to organize and which gives them some sort of political voice over the decisions that are going to affect their future. So thank you.